Hello and welcome to the Benjamin's Britain podcast, a series of conversations exploring Britain's past through its historic landmarks. Since 2016, I've been on a mission to visit every site described in a book, Landmarks of Britain, the 500 Places That Made Our History, written by the historian Clive Aslett, given to me as a Christmas gift from my mum, who I'm sure expected it to be read once before spending the rest of its life gathering dust on a shelf. This book has transformed my experience of living in Britain and my appreciation of 9,000 years of our history. My original goal was simple, take a photo at each site. But since those early days of visiting landmarks on my own, without anyone in the world knowing what I was up to, this project has snowballed into something I could never have imagined, with over 80 of my friends, family and colleagues joining me on adventures across the whole of Britain. Each visit involves a historical site, but just as fun, sometimes more so, has been exploring and enjoying parts of the UK we've never visited or heard of before. In this podcast, we'll be discussing the castles, caves, cathedrals, country homes, council houses, and countless other historical landmarks we visited together, delving deep into the past, whilst also exploring the highlights of our experiences in new areas of the country. We've learned that any list of historical landmarks is a very personal choice. The sites you choose inevitably reflect your own interests and experiences. So we'll be asking each guest to bring their own historical landmarks for inclusion in our alternative list of historical sites personal to the Benjamin's Britain community. I'm Ben, and this is Benjamin's Britain. Today's guest is Nikki Pavitt, a fellow graduate of history from the University of Exeter, an all-around historical landmark, Kino.
Good evening, Ben. It is a pleasure to be on the first podcast. How are you?
Things are good, Nikki. 2020 has seen hardly any landmarks, but I'm pleased now we've got a podcast up and running to fill that gap a little bit.
Yeah, at least we can talk about them if we are not visiting them, I guess.
I think 6 months without any landmarks is probably the longest stretch I've ever gone. Since starting this, thanks Corona.
I guess also over time it's reducing as well, because the density of landmarks is reducing, I suppose.
I mean, when I started and I lived in London, I mean, as we'll discuss, you could literally do 10 plus landmarks in a day because they were all so close to each other. Now it's pretty much a dedicated weekend to do any landmark.
Yeah.
So yeah, Corona came at a bad time for historical landmarks, but it's allowed us to diversify the Benjamin's Britain project a little bit.
No complaint. Yeah.
I'll always find a way. This weekend I'm driving my brother to university in Birmingham, where he's going for his fourth year, and little does he know we will be visiting a historical landmark on the way.
I like a sneaky one. I did actually get you to go to an unexpected landmark quite recently.
Oh, my first ever surprise landmark. Yeah.
The best kind. Yeah. Today we're going to be talking about my first landmark, which was a surprise.
Yeah. I mean, how many landmarks have you done, Nikki, in total?
So there's 500 in total, isn't there? I think it's around 70 something.
I think that's correct. The 100th will be upon us, I'm sure, maybe in a few years' time. But yeah, today we're going to be discussing your first. I mean, you never forget your first. I've done 333,
wow,
which is an awfully neat number to kind of be sitting on. And I started in, number one was January 2016.
Yeah.
So I'm approaching the 5-year anniversary of this project.
And what was the first one?
And I got the book as a Christmas gift. And in January, a few weeks later, I was visiting my mate Chris in Bristol, who might be listening to this podcast right now.
Maybe.
There, maybe. And one of the sites was in Bristol, and that was the SS Great Britain, which was Isambard Kingdom Brunel's steamship, which crossed the Atlantic, I believe. And we didn't even go there. We took a rubbish picture from a distance on a rainy January day, and that was photo number one. And to be honest, I had no idea what I was going to do.
What you find like you should put yourself.
Yeah, I really unleashed a demon there.
Yeah.
pretty quickly after that, I realized I was going to rise to the challenge of visiting every site in this book.
That's madness. Yeah, I've been to the SS Great Britain twice, I think. I went
twice.
I went once as a kid with my family. I remember one of my distinct memories of it is I had a Polaroid camera. I don't know if you ever had one, but you used to get about 10 shots in one go, and they were really expensive, so you had to use them wisely. It was like, don't mess this up.
The precious, yeah.
And I had one left. And we went to the SS Great Britain, and I was like, okay, I'm going to get a really good picture. And I think I must have been about 9 or so. What then happened is my 1 to 2 year old sister at the time, finger right down on the red button, picture of the floor. I had a Polaroid picture of the floor of the SS Great Britain.
That counts. Definitely counts.
Yeah.
As we've learned during doing this project, out of the 500 landmarks, you've probably visited over half of them just from your childhood adventures with your family.
Yeah, so you say I've done 70 or 75 or whatever it is, but actually those are only the ones that I have visited with you. Unofficial figures are looking more like, I don't know, 150, something like that. I went to a landmark this weekend.
Where? Which one?
One that you've already done. I went to Hampton Court Palace.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Henry VIII, so.
Yeah, I actually was on a date with Henry, the boyfriend. Ooh. But
Henry
not,
the Ninth.
Not Henry VIII, yeah. although they both have red hair, so I don't know.
Maybe
a weird coincidence.
Maybe this Henry is a descendant of the original Henry.
Oh, that'd be fantastic, wouldn't it? I mean, he's not got a good track record, but that's a podcast for a different day, I think. Tudors.
I'm sure Henry will come up. Nikki, before you started doing landmarks in your spare time, had you always been into history?
Yes, I would say so. I used to go to lots, as we've discussed, with my dad, with my family. And then, I don't know where the interest came from. I guess when you go to historical places in person, it brings about a different type of interest than it does if you're just in the classroom reading a book or someone's telling you about something. I mean, don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed learning about the Egyptians and Victorians in school, but you go and see things and then it sort of comes alive. But then, yeah, I don't know, it sort of developed over the years, did GCSEs, A-levels, and then studied history. And that's how we met.
It is. Why on earth did you decide to study history at university? What a waste of time.
Well, I know, right? What do you do with a history degree apart from do a podcast 10 years later? It was a choice between history or maths. I think I made the right choice.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You can't do many podcasts about maths.
I bet they're out there. You made the right choice. I was going to study law at university. But yeah, it was more my parents' decision than mine, to be honest. Mm. And when I went to a university open day at the University of Oxford, we got a tour of one of the beautiful libraries there. Mm-hmm. And it was a law tour, so we went to the law section. And I tell you what, I was not interested at all, but politely attending the tour. And I found myself drifting over to the history section. I'm picking up a book, I'm flicking through it and thinking, oh, look at that. And it was just a light bulb moment for me that this is what I have to study, not law. Didn't interest me in the slightest. It's got to be history.
Decision. I mean, you can always convert to law, you know. You don't need to do a law degree.
Nah, it's a waste of 3 years.
Yeah, we made the right choice.
Yeah, 100%.
As did some of our friends who will probably join us on this podcast at some point in the future.
In fact, you know, most of our university group were history students, right?
It was, yeah. And some law. A couple of those.
Can you remember finding out about this project for the first time?
I do. I think we were in the pub, as we are usually.
Standard, yeah.
When you used to be in London, that is. And you and Alex turned up and you said, we've been to a Battersea Dogs and Cats home, which is a very strange thing to do for two friends that aren't looking to cohabit and own.
Don't have cats or dogs.
Pet. And I can't remember what you said, but, you know, it must have been something along the lines of, oh, yeah, I've got this book and about historical landmarks, and I cannot wait to find out why that's historical, because I haven't got a clue.
What, Battersea Cats and Dogs Home?
Yeah.
I cannot remember in the slightest.
I bet you didn't really care that much at the time.
We didn't go in. We just got a photo outside back then. I think that was like the 10th landmark ever or something. It was just a photo and then off to the pub. I mean, it still is for a lot of them.
Most of them, yeah, it's true. I did go to the pub after Hampton Court, I have to say.
Rightly so. It's part of the experience.
It is. I don't know if we went to a pub when we went to the Churchill War Rooms, though.
Well, now we know. We are today talking about the Churchill War Rooms.
Woohoo!
The underground complex that housed the British government during the Second World War.
Spoiler alert.
Had you ever been to the Churchill War Rooms before we visited?
I had not. And in fact, that's how I believe you lured me into this project in the first place, by suggesting, Nikki, have you ever been to the Churchill War Rooms? And I said no. And I have an interest in Churchill. I suppose I did a number of essays about Churchill at university. We did a presentation about Churchill in one of our modules.
He's quite hard to avoid when you're studying a history degree, isn't he? He's kind of everywhere.
Yeah, so I did some electoral politics stuff, boring. And then we did a presentation about eugenics, and which included Churchill's views. So I'm well aware of the controversial views of Churchill.
Yeah. But highly divisive figure, Winston Churchill.
Exactly. Good and bad, I'd say, as I'm sure most people are.
Indeed. No historical figure is going to come out really smelling of roses when you dive into their views. I'd never been nor heard of the Churchill War Rooms.
Heard of?
You know, maybe I'd seen them in TV and film. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't know they were a place you could visit. And for those who know London, you can find them basically in between Downing Street and the Houses of Parliament. Underground. It's a museum today, but that's where the war rooms were located.
And it's a Imperial War Museum. It's connected. Mm. It's one of their five sites.
I remember it being a pretty impressive landmark.
It was good. I think it was probably expensive to go in. Those things always are a bit pricey, but, and that's probably the reason why I hadn't been in the first place, to be honest. I think it was summer.
I knew it was a landmark to be ticked off. You had no idea.
No idea. Totally unknown. The two things I remember the most from the Churchill War Rooms are, one, the Churchill Museum part, which was like an interactive, I imagine quite new exhibition space, and that massive digital desk table in the middle, which you could touch and you could select years, not just years, not just months, specific days of Churchill's life, which you could click on, and it tells you what he did and who he met, sometimes what he had for dinner, which was usually something extravagant.
In the bathtub.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never seen anything in a museum like it, where you can zoom in onto a historical figure's day and hour and find out what they were up to. It was insane. Very impressive.
You know, I can't remember exactly the amount of years it covered, but obviously during the war years, that's quite intense. You know, there's an awful lot going on. You don't get weekends if you're the Prime Minister during World War II, that's for sure.
We should probably discuss what actually went on in the cabinet war rooms. What went on there, Nikki? What happened at this place?
Well, I guess I never actually said what the second thing that I remember from it was, but the second thing I was going to say is just walking around all the individual rooms, the corridors that connect to all these, you know, various rooms. And essentially it was almost, I guess, like a mini Parliament Whitehall underground. Mm. So I know they had a BBC broadcasting room for radio. They had bedrooms. They had Churchill's bedroom, I believe, although...
He had a bedroom down there, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if he spent that much time there. I don't think he did. I can't imagine him being that scared.
He lived in Downing Street, didn't he? So I suppose it wasn't a long commute for him.
I can't imagine him going, oh God, I'm really scared of them. I'm really scared of these bombs. Like, it doesn't seem very Churchill to me.
Well, they built it underground, didn't they? Because they thought London was going to get bombed in the war. And obviously they were absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. So built it underground so they could carry on with government operations, even in the face of German bombing, which was, you know, a really smart decision.
Yep, entirely true. His wife had a room there.
Really?
Yeah, but they weren't the same room.
They had separate rooms.
Yeah. And I mean, I can't remember it in full detail, but I think they had like a big map room, big tables for basically a cabinet meeting.
Yeah, I think the map room is probably the most iconic part of the cabinet war rooms. When I think of our day there, I think of the map room, you know, and you've seen it in movies and you've seen it in TV. It's the actual room where the maps are plastered over the walls and over tables. And you can imagine men on telephones getting updates about where their different armies were.
Pushing. Beep, 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 beep.
Yeah, that's it. You know, with the little dots and strings over the map, plotting invasions of countries. Like, that is the Churchill War Room. That's what's going on down there.
Real life Risk.
They were playing Risk in real life. They actually were.
Yeah. It's hard enough as it is, but when you're throwing in like actual lives and...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, real, very much real life Risk. And, you know, it wasn't just a boys club, was it? There were men and women, all loads crammed down in there, all the secretaries.
Yeah.
I think there must have been hundreds of different bodies down there, all busy at work. It featured really heavily in the film about Churchill, which came out with Gary Oldman.
Oh, so many films, so many TV shows.
So many Churchill films. But I think that Gary Oldman Churchill film, it came out a few years ago. I think most of the action took place in the war rooms. And in that film, Churchill was portrayed as being on the loo, on the phone to the President of America, which... In doing a bit of homework for this podcast, I read was a real thing. One phone down there which had a direct line to the White House, and it had to be scrambled through bits of machinery spread across London, and it was in the same room as the toilet. So Churchill would have been on the loo chatting to Franklin Roosevelt, pleading with him to get involved with the war.
Eventually worked. I mean, the Americans get involved at some point, don't they? It's all good, really.
They do, and maybe they use the cabinet war rooms. Who knows?
Maybe.
I also learned, and this was a fact from Clive Aslett himself, that the Germans never found out about the war rooms. Mm. And we know that because it never featured in any official German documents. And it would have. It would have been a target, right? The theory is that the Germans never found out about its existence. And here in the heart of London, underground, was basically the beating heart of, you know, the Britain's war effort. It closed, unsurprisingly, at the end of the war. And that was it. The war rooms were open for the period of the Second World War, and then they were never used by a future government. They were just forgotten about, I think, for decades, decades and decades and decades, until they were opened up as a museum 20 years ago or something.
I'm relieved. Because if there was a need for it, that would have not been a good reason, would it?
That's true. Although I must say, if I was a prime minister, I'd kind of want my own little secret lair. Yeah. There's something exciting about that.
How do you know there isn't one?
Damn, you're right. You're right. Theresa May definitely had a bunker somewhere.
Yeah, Boris is for sure in a bunker.
Boris, yeah.
100%. I bet he sits there and he does pretty much as Churchill did. He just sits there on the toilet, calling up Trump, swigging on his champagne. He's having a great time.
I think Boris desperately wants to be like Churchill. He desperately wants to be the Churchill of the 21st century.
I think you're right, yeah. They've had a similar trajectory as well.
Interesting, yeah. Boris Johnson actually wrote a very entertaining book about Churchill.
That's so true.
I think Churchill is very much his hero. And I think Boris would love the comparison, really.
I think you're probably right there. He lived at 90 years old as well. I mean,
was he 90 when he died?
Imagine that, getting so fat on so much food and booze and just smoking cigars until the cows got home and living to 90. That is, there must be something was keeping him going, wasn't it? British spirit or something.
Bulldog spirit. Yeah. He had a famously unhealthy lifestyle, didn't he? Mm-hmm. and used to drink. Wasn't he known for just getting drunk at work and, you know, taking meetings from his bed because he was so lazy?
Hey, it worked, didn't it?
Got the job done, I suppose. Do you have a favourite TV or film portrayal of the big man himself, of Winston Churchill?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, Gary Oldman won the Oscar, but I do like John Lithgow in The Crown.
He's so good as well. He's so good.
He looks the most like him without having to wear prosthetics, I think. And I thought he was really good.
There must be dozens of Churchills in films.
There are. There's loads.
Of course, he was the man who was voted the greatest Briton of all time.
Yeah, that's true. Which is so interesting. It's so interesting. I wonder why. I don't know whether because we've studied him, whether that makes him more of a balanced person in our minds, because we can see the good and the bad. You know, he's definitely got problematic opinions, but a great wartime leader. It's interesting that the British people don't, you know, see him as the greatest, which is quite fascinating.
You mean today, I don't think he'd win the top of that vote.
Yeah, it wasn't even that long ago, though, I feel. No. I feel like it was 10 years ago, maybe.
I think there's definitely a Churchill myth. And
yeah.
I think for a lot of Brits, he represents the good old days.
Yeah.
Good, you know, like a fighting spirit. And I think he has a very nostalgic place in Britain's memories. And you can understand why.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't really fault him for being a fantastic wartime leader, but it's what comes before and after that that's kind of an issue. One of the things I wrote about in uni was why he lost the election after the war. It was basically because he was like, Japan, we have to defeat Japan. And everyone else was like, we're tired. We just want a new house. We don't want to live in this, you know, broken street anymore. We just want to be able to go to the doctors and get someone to look after us. And he wasn't that interested. He was just like, no, we have to beat Japan.
I remember being, I think I learned it at uni, that he was voted out in 1945, which came as just such a shock to me.
I know. I was surprised when I first realised that. I mean, obviously he then came back 6 years later or something. Is it six?
And that's when we saw him in The Crown.
Yes, correct.
With a young Queen Liz.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Churchill was Queen Elizabeth's first Prime Minister, of course.
Yeah.
The first of about 12 or 13 she's had since.
Oh, God.
Which is pretty excellent.
But, I mean, what a one to start on, though. It must be quite intimidating.
Yeah. And I think that was portrayed quite well in The Crown, that the power dynamic was very much with Churchill. He was the elder statesman and a bit of a legend by that point.
Yeah, exactly. And
the Queen was a young woman.
Yeah.
Suddenly in a very significant position of influence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite pleased you chose the Churchill War Rooms for us to discuss, because this, today, it's the 16th of September, and I think yesterday was the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. Or maybe it must be going on right now. It must be going on right now. And and of course, our response to the British side of the Battle of Britain would have been planned out from the Churchill War Rooms.
It all comes full circle.
It feels right to be discussing a World War II related landmark today.
Which is a coincidence, but a great coincidence.
You know, we're going to start rating these landmarks, Nikki, to see which ones come out as the best. And I've got a couple of categories I'd like you to rate the Churchill War Rooms against.
Excellent.
Out of 10, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
So firstly, historical significance. The historical significance of the Churchill War Rooms. How highly would you rate that?
That's got to be quite high, I would say.
Really important.
It kind of epitomises the Second World War and, you know, Churchill's leadership. So I would say historical significance, probably a 9.
Okay, it's a strong, strong start for the Churchill War Rooms.
It's going to be hard to get 10.
In fact, the Churchill War Rooms doesn't get a 10. I'm not sure what does. I would agree with that 9.
Mm.
Okay, secondly, how would you rate the fun factor of visiting this landmark?
You know what? It's surprisingly fun. I think that I think if you were a teenager on a school trip, you'd actually kind of enjoy it, you know, because it was quite interactive when we went. And I liked being able to walk around the ruins and see what it was like. I would go for a solid 6.
Okay, 6 out of 10.
Yeah.
I think that, yeah, that's about right. You know, it's good fun exploring all the tunnels down there, pretending like you're the one in the map room.
Yeah, exactly. Making the beep 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 noises that I did earlier.
That is fun.
So fun.
And now we are good millennials. So yep. Finally, I'd like you to rate the Churchill War Rooms on its Insta-worthiness, please.
I think it's going to be low, if I'm honest, because two reasons. I'm pretty sure we weren't allowed to take photos inside.
That I hate it when that's the case, but yes, okay, that might be true.
So kind of impacts the Insta-worthiness. So we took our photo outside with just a sign that says Churchill War Rooms, and it's quite boring. There isn't really anything external to take a picture of for obvious reasons. It was meant to be a secret. So I'm going to say a 1.
You know what? I think that is fair. I'm looking it up now. I think we took a rubbish photo outside. Yeah, we just stood by the entrance sign, didn't we?
Yeah, I think we were in the queue for it, actually.
No.
So it's not even a good memory.
I like to think our Instagram game has definitely improved over the years.
Yeah.
You know, today that photo would definitely be more creative. Maybe it would have involved a cigar and a Churchill bowler hat.
Yeah, we could have raided the gift shop for interesting things to wear.
So a 9 or 6. So Nikki, you have rated the Churchill War Rooms a 16?
Yep, 16. 16 out of 30. It's not great, is it?
It's what it is, you know. Yep. We'll compare this against other people's ratings of landmarks.
Oh, exciting.
At the end of this, we'll be able to see which landmark is the, you know, the nation's favourite.
Wow. I'm looking forward to that, actually. Yeah. After we get through 500 podcasts.
Yeah, 500 podcasts, yeah, 500 landmarks. Dear listeners, strap yourselves in.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets.
So, Nikki, for the next section of our podcast, we are going to be inviting each and every guest to bring their own historical landmark to the table. And we're going to be putting together an alternative list of 500 landmarks to visit. And, Nikki, I don't know about this in advance. Mm-hmm. So the only rules are it can't be in my book and it must be in Britain and it must have some historical significance, but that is up for you to interpret.
Ooh. And, very trusting.
Yeah, very trusting.
I hope someone picks something completely obscure. It's going to be great.
It's all going in.
So I have chosen something that is significant to me because it kind of combines my 2 degrees of history and higher education into one. And so I would say it enhances the women's history of our alternative list.
Much needed when you compare it to Clive's list.
Yes. So I have chosen to talk to you about Bedford College, which is in Russell Square in London. One thing that definitely is lacking from Clive's book is a bit of women's history.
It's embarrassingly true.
There aren't that many. We've probably got Jane Austen along the line somewhere, and Beatrix Potter. But you know, they're nice. But there's not a lot. So I've got a few interesting facts for you. So Bedford College is the first higher education college for women in the United Kingdom.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was founded in London in 1849.
That is earlier than I thought you were going to say.
Yeah. By Elizabeth Reed, who was a social reformer and anti-slavery activist. And she, basically, her husband died. She got loads of money from him when he died. And she was like, I'm going to start a women's college.
And was this before the days where women were going to university? Like, were women allowed to Oxford and Cambridge at this
point? No, but that I have got some facts about that for you.
I'm sure.
coming along. But this is the first, and it wasn't. So you wouldn't go there and get a degree. You would just go there to learn. It was as simple as turning up, and you didn't get anything out of it. It was just purely for your interest. I have no idea how the practicalities of that worked. Presumably, these women were fairly well off. But I can't say. But it's so the location is actually just around the corner from UCL. It's in Russell Square, which is close to my heart because I studied just off, literally around the other side of Russell Square. Was it Bedford Street? It might have even been called Bedford Street.
That would make sense.
Mm. So some interesting things about the college are that when Elizabeth Reed set up the college, she was like, I'm not going to let men run this. It's for women, and I'm going to let women run it for women. Wow. So it was actually the first British institution to be run by women.
What?
Yeah.
That is not well known enough, I don't think.
I know. It's amazing. And it had three women trustees right from the off. It was governed by women. I think there were men involved, but you know, it wasn't just a committee of men to start discussing what women were going to learn, basically. So in 1900, so around just over 50 years after it became a thing, it became a constituent of the University of London. Took a while. And it became fully co-educational in 1965. So actually not that long ago.
That's, you're talking about when men were allowed.
Yep, when men were allowed. Yep.
Wow.
So it took over 100 years for it to be open up to men.
Yep. That's so funny because when you think about the story of the 1960s, normally mm-hmm. is women being allowed into, you know, predominantly male institutions. This is the total opposite.
It is. So it sort of exists now, but actually it merged with Royal Holloway College.
Okay.
And now Royal Holloway University is kind of like consumed Bedford College.
Wow.
There we are. Some facts.
If you turned up there today, is there anything to mark that it's, you know, it's historical significance?
In Russell Square?
Sure. Yeah. The original
building. Yep, I didn't go there physically, although I was quite close today, but I went onto Google Maps and there is actually a blue plaque.
Nice.
So
nice.
You can actually see it and find out what it is. So that's quite nice. Some other things about it were that it had the first social sciences department in the UK. One of the first two women fellows of the Royal Society were from Bedford College.
Okay.
And it was the first art school in England where women could draw from life.
You mean nude?
Nude, indeed.
Wow, scandalous.
I know, can't believe it. So that's kind of the summary of it. But I did also look up some other general history about women's higher education.
This is such a Nicky Abbott subject.
I know. It was really interesting and fascinating, depressing, all in one. So I'm going to give you a guess at what university had the first residential college for women. So Bedford College was the first college they could go and study higher education, but which had, you know, where could you go and stay?
Well, sure, just because they're normally the first to do things. Was it Oxford?
No. Close.
Was it Cambridge?
It was Cambridge, yes. It was Girton College, Cambridge, which actually I was very close to choosing, but it wasn't the first. It wasn't quite the first. So Girton College was set up in 1869. It was first residential college, and Oxford founded Lady Margaret Hall in 1878. One thing I found out that was interesting about that is that they set up the college, but they didn't have anywhere to put the women. They didn't have any physical buildings. So they just used to do the classes above a bakery.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
from small beginnings? Because are there still women's only colleges at Oxford and Cambridge today?
I think so. I think there are.
I think so
too. I think some of them have merged, but I think there may be one or two.
I think there are, because they're the only all-women team you see on University Challenge is when
that's true.
That is one true. Of those colleges come up.
Some other small things. In 1869, the Edinburgh Seven were the first group of matriculated university female students at any British university, and that was the University of Edinburgh. And they were studying medicine. They never actually got a degree, though. They weren't allowed to get a degree. It was actually illegal, which is mad. This caused national attention. And one of the many supporters that were won around to their cause was someone who we'll probably talk about another time, Charles Darwin, of all people. Darwin was like, these women, get these women degrees now.
Wow, go yeah. Darwin.
Yeah.
This feels like a really important step in women's history.
Yeah.
Which has been a bit ignored, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this is 50 or so years before any women were able to vote. And it probably contributed to that in the end. People getting more educated and understanding that women can be educated as men. So, as men were, I mean. The first women to get actual degrees, BA degrees, were in 1880.
1880.
Yeah.
And, were the degrees in, your standard degrees at the time, sciences and maths and literature, or were they in more vocational subjects?
I think they were more, it doesn't actually say what these ones were, but I imagine they were similar. They, probably literature, maths, science, that sort of thing. Yeah. Because there weren't actually that many different subjects you could do at the time anyway. So, yeah, maybe medicine. So in 1897, a proposal was carefully worded. I'm reading this off a script, obviously. was carefully worded to grant women formal recognition of their degrees. So despite this, the Cambridge University rejected the notion by 1,713 votes to 662. That's a lot of men not in favour of women.
It's all men voting on that, yeah. All men, yeah.
I got this from the University of Cambridge website, and there's a picture of the riots that took place because the government had let women get degrees. Wow. And there are thousands of men on the street.
Why would anyone be so passionate against this?
I mean, it's just a step too far, Ben.
Wow, it's just not... Yeah, anything that gets women out of the house must have been a bad thing.
Exactly. They might start getting ideas and then want to vote. And
no.
Imagine. No. Then they'll steal all the men's jobs. Madness.
God forbid. Wow. Yeah.
So this picture's amazing. It's worth looking at it, actually, because it's just a huge crowd of men. It's mad. And it was apparently quite violent as well. So, yeah, that's Cambridge for you.
Do you think if you lived in 19th century London, you would have pushed to get educated at this college? Do you think?
I don't know. I think you probably had to be quite rich to go for it. You probably had to be in a fairly privileged position in the first place. So
that's probably true.
Probably not. maybe I'd have written a strongly worded letter or something.
I'm sure.
I have two more facts for you about women's higher education. The first lecturer. Female lecturer was a woman called Margaret Murray, who was a lecturer of archaeology, and that was in 1898. So that would have been the year after the government said that women could get degrees. So she wasted no time.
Where was she a lecturer?
I don't know, actually.
I wonder if it's going to be in Oxford, Cambridge.
She has a Wikipedia page. I believe it was UCL. It looks like UCL.
Mm. UCL should really celebrate that fact.
They should. Maybe they do. I'm not sure.
Maybe they do. Yeah.
I've got another question for you. So
I'm ready.
Obviously, there are a lot more universities now than there were, in the 1900s and so on. But which university was the last university to grant degrees to women? And when? Have a guess.
Oh, no. The last university?
Mm-hmm.
I really hope it's not somewhere like Cardiff or our uni, Exeter.
I don't think Exeter was officially a university at that point.
Okay. I'm going to say it's going to be somewhere traditional, like Durham. I think Durham was the last place.
No, but it is definitely traditional, and we may have already mentioned them.
Where?
It was Cambridge.
No, they had the Women's College.
Yeah, and I was gobsmacked. After all of this, they had the first ever women's residential college. They, you know, had all these riots in the 1897. But which year do we think?
Well, it must have been, it couldn't have been much later than that. I mean, not, you know, was it like First World War time, like 1920?
A little higher.
30?
More.
40?
It is the 1940s.
Wow.
1948.
That is so late in the day.
I know. 1948 to let women have degrees from Cambridge. That is nuts.
Sheesh.
I know. After all of that fuss, I think this is right, if I remember right from my reading, their very first degree was given to the Queen Mother. I don't think she did anything to deserve it particularly. No. I don't think she studied, but I think she got an honorary degree, and that was the first woman from the University of Cambridge to get a degree.
I don't remember that episode in The Crown, but you know, they really
yeah, I know. That's a juicy one. There we go. That's my history of Bedford College and women's higher education.
So good. Very personal to you. Nobody else would have chosen that.
Yeah.
My question to you is, if we turned up at Bedford College one day and we had to take a photo outside, what is the photo you'd want us to take? You know, we reenacted the beheading of Charles I at Banqueting House, and now we're at Bedford College.
So I'm just kind of looking around my room for inspiration, and I just so happen to see my dissertation on the bookshelf.
Yes.
I would have to bring my dissertation, probably something a bit not very sophisticated, just holding up my dissertation and just being like, yeah, here we go.
That feels so right. The women at Bedford College would have been so proud.
I know. Maybe one of the graduation caps as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I think that would be it. I bought one of those for my sister because she didn't get to have a real graduation because of COVID. So I could probably borrow it and throw it in the air, tossing a hat in the air.
That would be a great photo. That would be a great photo.
Yeah. And I would say, this is to you, Elizabeth Reed. Thank you for starting our journey into higher education.
Oh, it's beautiful. Very nice, Nikki. That is a good landmark. Mm-hmm. If not in Clive's book, as you rightly said, but in the list of 500 landmarks, alternative landmarks we're putting together, that's the first one in.
Congratulations, class of 2004. We did it!
Well, Nikki, thank you for being my first ever guest on my first ever Benjamin's Britain podcast.
My pleasure.
Churchill War Rooms is a great start, your first landmark, and a worthy one for us to be discussing today as well. And during COVID, maybe post-COVID, when it's safe to do so, where would you like to visit next in the Benjamin's Britain book? Do you have somewhere in mind?
I have always felt like I need to go back to Framlingham Castle.
Oh, I've heard you talk about that before, yeah.
In Suffolk. We went to Suffolk last year, but it was closed because it was winter. But it's somewhere I know I went with my family about, I don't know, three times as a kid. And I remember walking around the edge with one of those handheld walkie-talkie things that tells you about the castle. And it's just great. It's just a great castle. And it brings back childhood memories. So I really want to do that one.
Castles are definitely amongst the best of the landmarks. So I look forward to that. Thanks, Nikki. Next episode, we're going to be joined by Alex Green. And Nikki, as our resident historical landmark keynote and editor of this podcast, will be sticking around to join in the conversation, I do hope.
Yep, I will.
Great. So see you then.
Bye.